Pseudopod number 40 for June 1st, 2007. Today's story, Wanting to Want by Yuji Foster. Welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast magazine. I'm your host, Mer Lafferty. Every week, Ben Phillips and I strive to bring you the best in horror audio. Con season just started for me, and I just returned from Balticon 41, where I hung out with many fine people, including Pseudopod author Matt Wallace, our publisher Steve Ely, and not to mention many awesome Pseudopod listeners. And thanks to the listener who told me about the news story, about the little boy who found spiders in his ear. That didn't freak me out at all. As author Matthew Wayne Selznick puts it, the cons are recess for genre lovers, a place for us to go to reconnect with our tribe, and we definitely did that. Thanks to everyone who made it a special weekend, and I hope to see you at a future con. This weekend I'll be at A-Con in Dallas. July I'll be in Origins in Columbus, Ohio. August I'll be at Trinicon in Raleigh. And then of course DragonCon in Atlanta in September. I'm also hoping to make the podcast the New Media Expo, but that's still up in the air. If you're going to be at any of these cons, please stop me and say hi. I don't know my co-editor Ben's con schedule. You'd think I'd remember to check that before writing these intros, but maybe he'll tell you next time he does an intro. It was at last year's DragonCon that I finally met the fine writer Yuji Foster face to face. Ms. Foster is a frequent contributor to Pseudopod, giving us stories of ghosts, horrific sci-fi, and now, Wanting to Want, a story of desire and priorities. Ms. Foster lives in Atlanta with her husband and her pet skunk. She's been nominated for many awards, and her work can be found in magazines such as Darker Matter and Grendel Song. It's narrated by Tabitha Smith, a fanfic writer who runs the Strangely Literal and Buffy Between the Lines podcast. In theory, you're the same person at recess as you are in math class, only more so. Decide which person you are before listening, because I've got a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Wanting to Want by Yuki Foster. Biddy figured people who said San Francisco never got cold didn't sleep on the ground. She hugged her thin arms around her shoulders, pulling her raggedy coat tighter. Through the cardboard cracks overhead, the hazy streetlight turned the air into a muted yellow-gray. The glow looked sickly, not warm sunlight, sparkling stars, or friendly moon. It was cold and murky and hard, just like the night. The twitches were getting worse. A burning wire pricked her spine, lashing electric sparks into arms and legs. It had been a whole day since her last fix. She looked for her regulars as she paraded up and down 12th Street, but the cold was slowing down everything. Everyone. The hot blood just wasn't pumping in the Johns, and no takers meant no fix. Besides her, Dex Samek stirred. He cried out, limbs flailing, tossing the army blanket off. He'd been lucky. A sympathetic commuter had dropped a fiver into his cup, giving him enough to buy a crack rock. Now Dex was free of the concrete traffic island he and Biddy and a dozen or so other junkies called home. Winging over the grocery cart wagon train draped with cardboard, newspaper, and a tattered blanket. But he'd be back in an hour or two. Rolling to all fours made the twitches worse, like red-hot pins jabbing her insides. The pain in her neck flared hot as a match, a sharp, ragged sting that begged for scratching. It was the bad spot, the abscesses next to her shoulder where it chafed and rubbed against her shirt. She tried shooting up under her tongue to give that area rest, but it wasn't the same. The tongue hit too slow. The neck, with veins so close to the surface, was the best place for the needle, even if the area burned, weeping blood and pus on some days, bringing fever on others. She tugged the blanket back over Dex before crawling out of the Mike Chef shelter. Mike's cart was still unattended. He'd been gone for a week now. She felt uneasy as she rummaged through it, looking for his stash. While all the crew dropped out, now and again, it wasn't like him to be gone this long, without leaving word. Her half-formed concerns flitted away when her fingers found the cool, slick glass. There was a gulp of vodka left in the bottle wedged between a couple sock balls and Mike's pile of paperbacks. Guilt twinged her as she uncapped the bottle. Normally she would have asked Mike before taking his stuff, but he wasn't there and she needed it. Anyway, Mike would understand. He was always good about stuff like that, giving away his last sandwich or last hit to help someone worse off. The vodka coursed down her throat, bringing soft warmth and muted queasiness to her empty stomach. The junky twitches eased. They were still there, but she could ignore them again. It hadn't been a lot of booze. It wouldn't have been enough to stave off the pains for anyone else. There was another benefit of her size. The main one, of course, was the Johns. At 4'2", she appealed to the daddies. She cultivated the angle, talking in a high, little girl voice and affecting a silly, childlike manner when walking her beat. The way she figured it, as long as they were doing her, they weren't pawing their stepdaughters or nieces. And tricking the daddies was better than signing. She hated standing at the intersection with her cardboard placard, panhandling for loose change and the occasional bill. She couldn't bear the looks of revulsion, shock, and pity that people gave her. Worst of all were the folks who didn't see her at all. She sometimes felt like she was turning invisible, fading into nothingness from being ignored by so many people. At least the daddies never looked through her, and she could usually get $50 from them. Biddy picked up the worn cardboard sign that had, "Anything helps, even smiles," written on it in bold black letters. If she could get enough money for a $10 crack rock, or maybe a joint, just to tide her over, maybe a daddy would pick her up. She waited for the light to turn. When the flow of traffic paused, she weaved between cars, smiling and flashing her sign. If you could get them to look at you, maybe talk to you, they'd usually give you something. But this was a bunch of cruisers who weren't interested in making nice. She passed windshield after windshield with drivers staring resolutely forward. Her timing sense, honed by years of living by the blink red to green, alerted her to the changing light. She dashed for the island sanctuary. Sometimes people tried so hard not to see her, they actually didn't. Just last summer, some soccer mom in a minivan had crushed Mad Maggie, flattened her, just like that. You could never be too careful in traffic. Across the street, Chicken waved a hello from his wheelchair. At the next light's change, they both entered the halted traffic. Chicken had a battered sign that read, "Need money for food," propped up in his lap. "How's it going?" he called across the gleaming top of a cherry red Porsche. The Porsche's driver's eyes brushed over him. The click of electronic locks was as definite a no as it got. Chicken wheeled to the next car, a rusty silver Saab. "Pretty slow," Biddy called back. Chicken didn't reply. He was busy chatting up the Saab's driver, a young woman, maybe a student. Rewarded by a clatter of change, he grinned, displaying the stumps of his brown teeth. "Hey, sugar, you lost?" The voice was male and husky. Biddy had to stand on her tiptoes to see the shadow of a hand waving from a black Ranger 4x4. She skipped over, laying it heavy with her little girl bounce. "I might be looking for my daddy," she said. She beamed, hiding the abscesses in her neck with her hair, while she preened and posed. "Is your daddy a rich man?" "He gives me a $50 allowance." "You want to get in and maybe we'll see about helping you find him?" "Sure," Biddy clambered into the passenger side. The driver was younger than she thought, unusual for her normal Johns, tended on the downward side of middle age. He smelled faintly of cologne, the expensive kind. Crisp suited and clean-shaven, with closely cropped blonde hair, he looked more like a churchman than the guy on the make. "You a cop?" Biddy asked. It was a ritual with new customers. If you asked, and if they were, they had to tell you. The John shook his head, not even a little bit. She giggled. "It's funny," she explained, answering his puzzled sidelong glance, "because sometimes they call me Little Bit." "What else do they call you?" "Mostly everyone calls me Biddy." "My name's Jay Callahan." Johns didn't give their last names. It was probably a fake. "So where are we going?" she asked. "Where do you want to go?" "There's a cheap motel around the block, the Sleepaway. That's where my daddy usually takes me." The parking lot of the Sleepaway bustled with industry. A triad of dealers did brisk business next to the broken marquees, and full-size hookers lounged in cheap finery. Jake followed her to the motel's registration lobby. The early morning manager gave him a grubby key in exchange for Chris 20. 206, he muttered. "Be out in an hour." The motel rooms were identical inside. Stained walls, threadbare carpet, stench of stale cigarette smoke. Shoddy, but familiar. At least there were a place to get warm and shower. Inside 206, Jake fiddled and shifted from foot to foot. I don't know how to start this. This ain't your first time, is it? Jake grinned. I mean, I just want to talk. Talk, sure, but I wasn't kidding about the $50. Jake blinked and his jaw went slack. He brought hand to head and swayed. Hey, you okay? Was he messed up? Slut, how dare you speak to me? Jake dropped his hand and glared at her. The hate in his eyes was sharp, tangible within its hostility. But he backed away. He swayed again, staggering against a wall. No, I want to help you. I'm sorry. She eyed the door, judging whether he'd lunge for her if she rushed it. Faster than she thought he could move, he was on her. His hand lashed out and caught her temple. But he fell, dazed from the sunburst concussion. He backhanded her, and she tasted blood. She ducked his next blow, hearing the buzz of air as his fists missed her face, and dove for the only refuge, the bathroom. He caught a handful of her hair as she darted by, tearing locks out by their roots. She slammed the door and locked it. A howl, bestial and raging, chased after her. The flimsy pressed wood crashed as Jake threw himself against it. It wouldn't hold for long. The window behind the filthy shower was small. It would be a tight squeeze even for her. The catch was old and rusted. She tore her nail in panic. The hurt was sharp, but nothing compared to the mad violence that beat and hammered at the door. She jumped, catching her hands on the sill, and struggled to pull herself up. Teeth gritted, she dragged herself across the gap. Her head and chest cleared, but wedged at the hips. Squirming and fighting, she felt muscles pull. Behind her, the door banged open. With a frantic shout, she twisted free, her hips screaming at the abuse. Dirt and rocks rushed up from two stories below. She landed poorly, with one wrist twisted under, a firebrand of agony and the crack of fragile bones. Then there was darkness. Biddy felt like she was swimming through mercury air, silver and thick. She emerged, blinking, in a hospital room. Her body was one solid bruise. Someone had stuck an IV needle with the attached solution baggie in one arm. Pretty amazing that they'd been able to find a vein. She could have sworn she collapsed all of them. The other arm was swathed in a hard cast bound light to her chest. Everything hurt, but the pain told her she was alive, and that was something. The divider curtain twitched aside to reveal a nurse in gleaming white. Her mouth pulled down, and limes framed her eyes with worry and something else. Resignation and mislaid compassion. What happened? Biddy said. The nurse adjusted Biddy's pillow with hands that were firm but gentle. Someone phoned in a 911 call saying that a child fell out through a two-story window. Ambulance brought you here. The old protective instinct, even from an anonymous helper, had saved her again. Feel up to answering some questions? I guess. Name? Betsy Klein. There had been a time when saying that old name would have made her feel uneasy, sad. But that time was long ago. Now it was nothing. It belonged to someone else. A different life. Age? 32. The nurse didn't raise an eyebrow, but her eyes flickered to the track marks on Biddy's arms. The ID card of a hardcore junkie. Is there anyone we should contact? Biddy shook her head. Her daughter would not welcome another call from her mother in the hospital. Susan was a smart girl. A good girl. Raised by her brother's family. Susan would end up better than her mother had. It's probably pointless to ask about insurance, isn't it? Afraid so. Do you remember anything? Biddy shook her head. She did, every second of it, but she knew better than to tell. Telling led to cops. When can I get out? She asked. The doctor wants to keep you overnight. We have you on an antibiotic drip for the abscesses on your neck. Oh. Any use giving you the lecture about staying clean and off the streets? If it'll make you feel better, Biddy said. She believed in being honest with care people. But I've heard it before. The nurse nodded, didn't say anything else, just slipped through the privacy curtain. She left the rustle of bedclothes and the sigh of other patients behind. Of course they hadn't given Biddy a private room. At least it was clean, and whatever they had in her IV baggie kicked the junky twitches, for now at least. But in the quiet, away from the tightrope walk of heroin surge and withdrawal, brought long, still thoughts whirling up. The last time she'd been clean had been when she was pregnant with Susan, 9 years ago. She stayed off the stuff for almost a year, for the baby, but the cravings had won out. In the end, even the soft hands and curious eyes of her daughter hadn't been able to lure her from the junkie call. The rehab folks all knew it, so did she. The fact of the matter was she didn't want to kick. In order to make the break, she had to want it, and she didn't. The kiss of the needle, the ecstasy of the first rush, lapping waves of the cradle of heroin high, they were all so wonderful. Too wonderful. Biddy had to want to get clean, but wanting to want wasn't enough. It just wasn't. Although missing Susan hurt almost as bad as junkie pains. Almost. Mommy does love you, sweetheart, but she's too messed up. Her own tears surprised her. She thought the dope had damned them. But no, they came, quietly and without fanfare, trickling in salty droplets down her cheeks. Biddy, Biddy, wake up. Someone was shaking her. That was unusual. Junkies on the island let folks be if they could manage a few hours of unconsciousness, natural or drug-induced. She opened her eyes. It was Jake, the John that had put her in the hospital. He hovered over her, his brown eyes soft and worried. She screamed, or tried to. He clamped a hand over her mouth before anything bigger than a squeal could escape. Sorry, sorry, please don't scream. I won't hurt you. I'm better now. I'm all better. I'm taking my hand away now, see? Biddy curled her fingers around the red call nurse button. What do you want? I wanted to tell you I'm sorry. I was another person. He's gone now. I should have waited until he was gone. He was crazier than Mad Maggie. Sure, no problem. Thanks for visiting. He reached into his pocket. Biddy tensed and then sagged when he didn't pull out a weapon. He'd grabbed bills. 20s from what she could see. He held out a thick, crumpled wad of greenbacks. Biddy's hand opened, dropping the call button, and snatched the cash. Calculating how much high she could buy, she shoved the money, furtive as a thief, between her cast and her arm. What's it for? Her voice held the suspicion that her body belayed. I was hoping we could still talk. Biddy retrieved the call button. About what? Mike's a friend of yours, isn't he? Whatever she had expected him to say, it wasn't that. You know Mike? Knew him. He died of the flesh-eating disease. What they're calling necrotizing fasciitis. Time slowed, like when the needle went in, right before the plunger pressed home. The air shivering with sluggish weight, and everything but her thoughts in a quagmire of waiting. It was his leg, wasn't it? She murmured. He never took care of it. He'd unwrap it when he wanted a straight fix. Let him pump straight into the vein. On hot days it smelled like rot. I'm sorry. The spin of the world picked up, returning to its usual pace. It was all the morning people like her were allowed. How'd you know Mike? We used to hang out, shoot up together on the island, but I kicked. You used to load up? I was hardcore. Biddy let the call button fall. Another junkie. That explained it. She knew other folks you had to watch for freakouts. It happened. What you doing back? I'm sort of a messenger to tell people like Mike, like you, about a way out. A good way. I've been in rehab and jail. I've tried it all. I used to be the worst sort of junkie you ever saw. The magic man fixed me up. Jake plucked a creased card from his pocket. She'd taken the cash. She might as well take the card. It had a West End address on it. It was worn, like hands before hers had clutched it, crumpled it, and worried it between grimy fingers. So, you know, have a good life. And then Jake was gone. When the nurse came back with her lunch, Biddy caught her sleeve. Can you tell me how I can find out if Mike Oldenburg was admitted here? Are you related? Biddy nodded. Mike and she, they'd gone into the ER once. Her, feverish from the abscesses in her neck. Him, with his leg smelling like rancid meat. She didn't want to go, but he coaxed her, agreeing to check himself in only if she came along. That was Mike, always taking care of other folks, even if he never took care of himself. As a joke, they'd listed each other as emergency contacts. Next of kin. I can run a search on the computer after my rounds, okay? Thank you. Biddy flashed the nurse her best little girl smile. The woman's face took on the maternal, compassionate look. The old protective thing. Care people dripped with it. When the nurse returned, she had a clipboard with an official-looking form on it. Was his name Michael James Oldenburg? Yes. I'm so sorry. He came in 2 days ago with a fever. His leg was infected. He's dead, isn't he? I'm afraid so. The verification was like an echo of pain, troubling but distant. May I see him? I'll need to talk to the doctor and... whatever. Not like I'm going anywhere. They were fast. A pair of orderlies brought in a wheelchair and a mobile stand for her IV. They bundled her in a blanket and carted her to the morgue. The attendant on duty pulled out a drawer, one of a row after row of identical cold units. He tugged the sheet down, enough for her to see the face. It was Mike, shaggy, friendly, good-natured Mike, always ready with an encouraging word and a helping hand. His skin was pasty white, and his eyes had sunken in their sockets. Death had left little dignity when it stole him away. That's him. They wheeled her back in silence. She couldn't erase the image of Mike's pale face from her mind's eye. Reflected in it, she saw herself. Maybe tomorrow, victim of some weirdo. Maybe next year, felled by infection, disease, or an overdose. She walked the same path Mike had, even knowing where it led. When the hospital released her, at her request, they deposited her into a waiting taxi. Normally, a taxi was unheard luxury. Why, the fare alone would pay for a half-day's high, but she needed to go to the West End. The address belonged to a ramshackle apartment building. It didn't have the look of a project residence. The light fixtures were unbroken, the windows free of bar or board, and dealers didn't loiter in front. But it wasn't rich, either. It looked dingy and sad, like an old postcard or a half-forgotten memory. It made her glum, like the ache inside that happened before tears. She almost told the driver to turn around, to take her back to the island and the dreary-eyed despair she knew. But she got out and watched the yellow checkerboard whisk away, scattering dead leaves and city debris in its wake. The card said apartment 612. She had to stand on her toes to reach the intercom. Biddy waited, tottering from foot to foot, and listened to the buzzer sound. It cut off midway after a third ring. Yes? Hi, Jake told me to see the magic man. The electric lock clicked. Come on up. There was no elevator, or rather, there was one, but a large sign declared it was out of service, while doors hung open revealing a dark cage, lifeless and foreboding. Or rather, there was one, but a large sign declared it out of service, while the doors hung open revealing a dark cage, lifeless and forbidding. Biddy had to pause 3 times on the landings as she made the 6-story ascent. Her legs were short, and she was unaccustomed to walking anything more rigorous than her beat. She arrived, flushed and out of breath, at 612. The door swung open before she could knock. The magic man, for it could be none other, was beautiful. There was no other word for it. He had long auburn hair that rippled on down his back, gleaming with highlights of burnished red. He was tall, although everyone was tall to Biddy, with porcelain-pale skin and autumn brown eyes. "Welcome, and be at ease," he said. "I am the magic man." Odd, Biddy drifted in. "Won't you have a seat?" He indicated a low chair, appropriate for her, like most furniture was not, while he sat in a faded easy chair upholstered with a pattern of amber rabbits, their faces upturned to a frosty moon. She perched, gaping at him. "You want my help, yes?" he asked. She nodded, mute. "You want me to give you escape from something you've been running from, but can't bring yourself to leave behind." "How do you know? That is, I don't have a lot of money." She struggled to recover her streetwise aplomb. The essential mindset a crack whore needs to survive. The magic man laughed. It was perfect, as lovely as he was. Biddy could have listened to his laugh. Eschewing food, sleep, maybe even crack. "I don't want your money." "Then what?" There was always her usual trade goods, but with looks like his, she doubted he ever wanted for companionship, much less had to pay for or barter for it. "I desire what you do not." "I don't understand." "You give me all the pain and misery of your old life, and I replace it with a new, shiny, fresh one." Even if I could, why would you want it? I deal in commodities. Some people place a high value on other people's discards. What do I have to do? Give me your name, your whole name. Give it to me and everything you are with it. I'll give you a better one, a new one. That's it? That's it. It was a curious proposition. Would she trade her life if she could? Would she give up who she was, her past, her future, her now? Yes, she would. You want it? You got it. The magic man stood. Come with me. She trailed at his side as he urged her into the recesses of his apartment. She'd expected a bedroom. Instead, it was a study or library, illuminated by dozens of pillar candles that burned in incense sconces. The walls were lined with books, and the floor was lustrous hardwood, elegant and warm. In the center of this luxury, a glass sculpture squatted on a marble pedestal. It was abstract and rough and smooth and gleaming by turns. From one angle, it was a figure crouching or leaning. From another, a leering face. And there was something bestial about it, a feeling of claws or fangs at the ready. The magic man led her to the pedestal and set her hand, fingers entwined with his, atop the glass statue. She had to stretch. Repeat after me. I, state your full name, doff my name and give thee it and all that is mine by it. I, Betsy Veronica Klein, doff my name and give thee it and all that is mine by it. She stumbled over the unfamiliar, archaic words. Again. The glass was chilly. The glass was chilly. Ice cold. Her fingers tingled. Or maybe it was just the awkwardness of her arm above her head. I, Betsy Veronica Klein, doff my name and give thee it and all that is mine by it. Again. The magic man's voice dropped into a low croon. He annotated syllables. Perhaps they were words, or maybe not. They punctuated her declaration, wrapping around it like a glove. I, Betsy Veronica Klein, doff my name and give thee it and all that is mine by it. Under her hand, the glass sculpture shifted. A translucent limb unfurled from the base, tipped with a glittering claw. It gripped her finger, and where it touched her skin, it burned. Burned the way frozen metal on naked flesh burned, the way ice on an open sore burned. It seared her with a frigid, icy cold. Biddy tried to pull away, but the magic man held her. The burning freeze spread like a lightning strike down her arm, engulfing her body. She screamed when it struck her heart. When she opened her eyes, she was in the magic man's reception room. She recognized the moonstruck rabbits beneath her. Hello, Marie Jane Benning. Do you feel better? I guess. What happened? You fainted. You murmured something about the incense and tipped right over. Gave me quite a fright. Oh, sorry. Not at all. I'm glad you're feeling better. Would you like something? A glass of water? She... Moriah? Shook her head. No, I should be going. The purse at her ankles was worn, the strap burnished with age. She rummaged in it, past the canvas wallet, the lipstick, and the hairbrush, before her hands closed around the jags and points of her keys. She stood, and for a moment the room tipped. The room shivered and sparkled like a heat wave over burning pavement. She felt too tall, towering like a giantess over furniture seen in a new angle. It made her lightheaded and confused. But the magic man was unmoving, solid, an anchor in a jumbling chaos. The vertigo passed, and she nodded the farewell to her host. She weaved her car, a grumbly two-seater, inclined to stall or race, into traffic. If she hurried, she might miss the worst of the commuter rush. Cruising past the traffic divider at 12th and Mission, she averted her eyes from the man in the wheelchair begging for handouts. Fortunately, the light was with her. She didn't have to stop and endure his intentions. Home in her apartment, Moriah stuck a cast roll in the microwave and switched on it to the television. She hated the news. It was always full of depressing stories of people sick or mad or just plain bad. Victims, unfortunates, and criminals. Sometimes, though, an image of or plight caught her attention. Good fodder for her muse. Nothing today, though. Just the latest political scandal and another missing child. They showed a picture of the little girl laughing. The sunlight golden on her cheeks, her skin glowing with warm, wholesome shine. Her dark hair was frozen, in perpetual disarray, raspy wisps curled around her cheeks. There was something about her. Normally, Moria wasn't interested in children. Their shrill voices, tactless natures, and boundless energies exhausted her, made her self-conscious. But this last child was different. The plastic announcer recited her name, Susan Klein. Moria felt sorry for the parents as she switched off the set. That night, casseroles pleasantly digesting and pastels in hand, the little girl from the television haunted her. How the sun glittered in her hair, the crinkle of her eyes as she laughed. All details captured by her subconscious in a few seconds of airtime. Superimposed themselves on her current projects. A park gazebo where pigeons strutted and preened. She set aside the half-finished work and clipped a fresh sheet to her easel. She laid the colors of the girl's face on her canvas. Shades of peach, beige, and rose, the coral and pink of her lips, the bright highlights in her somber hair. The curve of her cheek, fanned by golden brown eyelashes, took shape beneath the points and edges of her pigment sticks. She knew the planes of this girl's face, had learned them intimately in a few moments of electronic vision. Moria registered the exhaustion that blurring her eyes with grit and fatigue. The cornflower blue curtains in her workshop were tinged with silver. Dawn peeked in as she worked. She painted the whole night through. Inspiration hadn't hit her like that in a long time. She had been afraid she lost it. The spark of creativity, the seer of passion. The magic man had promised to get it back for her. It seems he had delivered. The portrait of the girl, Susan, wasn't complete. The background was still too white and starky, but the face, eyes, skin, hair, were done. It was going to be one of her best pieces. She would finish it tomorrow. She needed to sleep now. As soon as her eyes shut, Moria submerged in a dreamscape with fairy tales. In return for the fresh garden greens, a witch had demanded her easel and palette. A tiny man wearing bells taunted her, his name withheld, while skeletons of woven gold gleamed at his back. A collage girl sobbed, smudging the colors of her face as pigeons devoured breadcrumbs leading from a sweetbread gazebo. Moria woke with her heart galloping. Her apartment was dark. Muted lights snaked in through the curtains from the streetlights outside, bringing a haze of yellow-gray and an uncomfortable sense of déjà vu. Crying girl, Susan, dimly recalled memories were as faint as old picture bleached by time. Moria had jeans and a colored, smeared smock on before she knew what she was about. She raced her car through traffic, discounting speed limits and stoplights alike, until she reached the magic man's abode. But though she leaned on the buzzer, no one answered. Moria hefted a section of cracked paving and hurled it at the glass door. It crashed through. Reaching past the broken glass, she flipped the lock. She took the stairs two at a time. Once she couldn't use such long strides. Why? And arrived, panting, at 612. The magic man's door was unlocked. Flinging it open, she stood braced. But no one came. There was nobody home. She crept in, her nerves live wires. But the silence spread, thick and absolute. No sounds of breath or rustle of clothing disturbed the still quiet. Moria tiptoed past the chair with reverent lapins. The inner sanctum was as she remembered it, although the candles were cold and dark. But where the glass sculpture had been, there was only a syringe and a cellophane bag of white powder. Moria, what can I do for you? The magic man's beautiful voice materialized at her back. My daughter, Susan. You have no daughter, Moria Jane Benning. You are a talented artist who came to me complaining of an absent muse. You offered a trade to me, your name for inspiration. His voice was so soothing, so beautiful. I do have a daughter, Susan. While hers were faint, lacking conviction, Betsy Veronica Klein had a daughter. She was a midget crack whore that catered to men of perverted tastes. Now, she is an artist. She is you. She was Moria Jane Benning, not a streetwalker, not this Betsy woman. Nevertheless, she remembered the heat of heroin in her veins, the bouquet of smoke in her lungs. She wasn't Betsy either. She was Betty. Betsy agreed to give up everything that was hers, the magic man continued. Susan was hers, and now she is mine. No. You cannot have both, Moria and Susan. Your choice. But choose carefully. After all, your friend Mike appreciated his trade. What? Jake Hallahan was Michael Altenberg. Mike took his name after a clinically psychotic man, prone to violent fits. He begged me to stop them, so I did. I helped them both, the way I helped you. Jake, or Mike, whoever attacked me. Violently, in a fit. The last ghost of Jake's troubles. It passes. What do you get out of this? I save people and give them what they want. If I keep a little beauty, the promise of a child's potential, there's only me. The magician wasn't a care person, he was a dealer. A stinking, filthy dealer, like the pushers and dope boys who preyed on people like her. Dealers always had an angle. They always got a cut of the take. I want Susan. He pointed at the syringe on the pedestal. So take back your name. If I dope up again? Susan will be beyond you, as before, yes. But you won't have her. As you say. Biddy picked up the syringe. She had played at the wanting to kick it. But it was just that, a play. Heroine would be her daughter, her lover, her solace, as it had always been.
Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is produced under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license. This means you can scare as many friends as you like with it, just don't change it and don't sell it. Our theme is by permission of Anders Manga, and you can find them at andersmanga.com. Pseudopod is a paying market, so if you go to pseudopod.org, you might consider putting a couple of bucks in our tip jar so that we can pay our authors to continue to bring you fine horror. You need to help us fund your nightmares. If you like science fiction and fantasy, check out our sister podcast, Escape Pod, at escapepod.org. Next week, we'll endeavor to scare you again, if you'll have us.